Hiya, welcome to another episode of Zero Ambitions, a podcast about sustainability and the built environment. Up this week, we have Chloe Donovan of Natural Building Systems. Alex met her a few weeks ago and it introduced us to her. Obviously, we think what they're doing is interesting and so inviting her onto the podcast. They have a panelized modular building system using natural materials that is award-winning. It's adaptable, has a really interesting digital component to it in the design aspect to make it a eminently flexible system. And I mean, she's a really interesting person. That's the main reason we invited her on. Met her at Future Build, had a really good chat. And yeah, we managed to turn this around quite quickly. I mean, quickly for us. We talk about all sorts of things, including hemp, natural building materials, MMC, and the, well, seemingly chaotic nature of that industry at the moment. And I mean, the usual stuff you hear us talk about every week, if you listen every week. Anyway, you might as well just listen to it rather than listen to me banging on. Thank you for joining us. Cheers.
So, yeah, Chloe, I have heard about you. Good things, I should say. Unless I'm getting my wires crossed, my friends, a mutual friend of mine, Dan, an old university friend, who worked on the magazine as well that I published, Process Plus, for a period of time, the guy called Steve Molyneux.
Oh, yeah.
He's now a green councillor in Woodbridge in, what is that, East? Where is it? Where is Woodbridge? He mentioned Steve is prone to bouts of enthusiasm and fairness as well. He mentioned some sort of an open day or a trip to visit your company, and he was absolutely bowled over.
Yeah, he's been down three times now. So
oh, Jesus, right. Bringing, I'm sorry.
No. He's fantastic.
Apologies, yeah.
No, he's really great, and he keeps bringing all of his other fellow councillors down. So we've had the cabinet and then some, and they've actually supported some of our pilot projects and things. So, no, he's great, and actually Suffolk as a councillor have been really supportive. So,
that's really nice. He's great. Yeah, he's a great friend, and I resent him a little bit too as well in some ways, because he's got,
all of this.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I'm happy to. I kind of have that default, what's that expression, you know, the bulldog.
Bitterness?
A face like a bulldog that can piss off a nettle, right? That's me, you know? You know, I'm the kind of person that I've had actually on a couple of occasions in my life, people come up to me and ask me, you know, would it hurt you to smile? That kind of thing, right? Which is a great way to put somebody in the right frame of mind, really make your day. But Steve, one time, a bunch of years ago, he came to visit me when I was living in Blackrock. And he has this just very smiley, charismatic nature about him. Don't use that, actually, Dan. With the fear that he might be listening. And we're walking around my hometown in Blackrock. And people are coming up to him and they just start talking to him out of nowhere, you know? And I go around... Could not be more anonymous, you know, dodging spit. You know,
well, I mean, if the locals know you for licking piss off nettles, why would they want to talk to you?
It's metaphorical, then.
Right. Okay? Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, no, it's great. He's very enamored anyway with your system, and he showed me a little bit about it, but I won't let that pollute my brain too much. Let you, Chloe, kind of explain it yourself, really.
Well, we'll get into that shortly.
Yeah.
So, Chloe, have you changed microphone?
I did.
Is it using your headphones? I think it's a bit worse.
People tell me this. My headphones, but I'll put the microphone through the computer in that case.
Well, I'll start bollocking on while that happens. So we're here today with, I've got your surname, Chloe Donovan, that's it, of Natural Building Systems, to carry on a conversation about, natural building, or using natural materials for building, particularly in relation to the conversation about embodied carbon, carbon negative building, Jeff.
Stop it. Yeah.
Yeah. And carbon buffering, our preferred expression. Shout out John Butler. So we met through Alex, who met you at, what was that event? It was a build center thing.
At Future Build?
No, it was
the ASBP conference.
That was
Healthy Buildings conference.
So you were celebrating your award in public, was it?
Yes, we won the People's Prize for their product category for this year's awards.
And
fantastic. Congratulations.
Yeah, he was well deserved by all accounts. So Alex introduced us at Future Build and said you need to come on the podcast. And so there is, Jeff, a tangential thing. We might be doing something with Will Kirkman about productization of green building stuff, like the merchandising and route to market. So the four of us, Chloe, Will, Sam Baumber of Indie Nature, former guest, we were just bollocking on about all the problems with getting to market. And it feels like there might be something, a longer story, in the same way as we're going to produce that more a podcast stream with Tanya, and Alex is going to be working with Tanya on that, about a more granular set of approaches to the sustainability within the built environment. It is worth looking into the selling aspect, the product aspect, like just for its own sake. It doesn't have to be, it's not going to be something that runs forever, but I think a limited series and exploration, I think that could be really interesting.
I'd listen.
Yeah, look, the supply chain element is so important as well, isn't it? I mean, it's, you know, there's no point in an architect looking to specify the best materials in the world if they can't find a way to source them, and if they can't find a way to defend the specifications of it, well, you know.
And I think it's fascinating the trials and tribulations folk have getting something to market. Like go ahead, jump in.
No, I was just going to say, very much at the knife's edge of dealing with that at the moment, in terms of having spent 3 years basically on product research and development, and now really up against the whole roadmap to get it commercialized and scaled up, and the myriad of certification hoops and hurdles and options and roadblocks and absolute money holes along the way.
It's a funny one as well, you know, because there's a lot of kind of sort of pseudo requirements. You know, they're are they really required, or is there a perception that they're required, you know? And that you see that happening in the certification space. You also see in some instances significant issues arising with certifications and with certification bodies disclaiming all liability in the event that a product that has been certified to their system fails in spite of it complying with the cert, you know. So I think a lot of people think there's a sense, a sort of a false comfort sometimes that comes from certification, you know, in some instances, and that's something that really needs to be understood.
It's one of the first questions they ask you when you go through the process. They say, you want to be certified? Okay, what other certifications have you got? We'll certify you as long as you're already certified. You're like, great, yeah. Okay, brilliant.
It's tricky, you know, and you have things like standards in place in some instances. You know, that's the other frustrating thing, I suppose, that where you have traditional, so-called traditional construction methods, you have existing standards in place, which you're not required to show the same burden of evidence if you're following those conventional approaches in some instances, as you are with what in reality in some instances are actually more, in the true sense of the word, traditional build systems. So it's a very strange old setup, you know.
But yeah,
the more we talk about it, the more we help to, you know, I think the fundamental thing here as well is that we need a more enlightened, more building physics literate community of designers, of people in building control, and within the insurance industry, and right across the board, you know, to understand really what makes buildings work or fail. And I think as well, when you talk about so-called traditional construction, we're asking buildings to do things now that we've never asked them to do before, in terms of thermal performance, for instance. And, you know, the idea that you can look at a bunch of kind of past track record for a build system or whatever approach in that context, it's not the same building. It's not, I'm sorry. I should not invite a guest on and just start shiting on the floor should be yours, Chloe. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Right. So with that in mind, do you want to give us a bit of background about natural building systems? And then we'll get into your weird and wonderful background, because I'm sure you're not aware, Jeff, but Chloe is a farmer, first and foremost.
Yeah, I've certainly had a bit of an unconventional route into the industry, I would say. And so I guess just for the high level side of it, Natural Building Systems has developed a panelized construction solution that is all about trying to use natural and bio-based materials, but really trying to bring them together with innovative digital fabrication and kind of tech-led design tools, and then precision engineered manufacturing. So it's a CNC'd, which is a computer numerical coded cutting approach to engineering the parts. And then that creates panels that we've also designed for disassembly and adaption. So that's really what we are all about, is trying to effectively mainstream the use of natural materials by systemizing it, de-risking it through that insurance certification and accreditation process, so that we can actually start to unlock the bigger parts of the industry that are currently unable to use these types of materials due to the challenges with the supply chain and the skill shortages in the industry. So I guess my route into this was unconventional, in that I really just started out wanting to grow some hemp. I grew up in a farming community, and my grandparents have a farm, and I had a background actually working in the youth sector. And I just wanted to, I set up a project that was doing outdoor education on a farm. I became a trustee for a charity called the Food Ethics Council that got me really interested in like the systems level questions about food and farming. And I was just sick of seeing all of the farms in my local area growing maize for bioenergy, or switching to basically growing biomass crops, and how they aren't very good for the environment, but they do give a stable income to farmers. So I was trying to find a substitute that would give consistent high yields, that was good for the environment and critically good for nature. And that's where industrial hemp popped into the scene. And I've kind of become a bit of a fanatic ever since, I suppose. And you do tend to find that in the hemp world, but I think very much having come at it from a bit of an unconventional angle and not having any background in construction, actually, it was really kind of looking at the big picture and kind of going, well, why isn't this material used more, and what could I do about it?
But it's funny speaking with someone who comes at it from being a plant nerd rather than a buildings nerd. John Butler, Cyprian Edmonds, who's coming on soon. We need to book that. Like, they're nerds for straw bale as a consequence of the other things that they've done. But you've come at it from wanting to cultivate the plant, from appreciating a completely different system rather than the building system, like a broader, well, the agricultural system.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is a bit broader than that as well, because I guess I'm a kind of typical millennial who feels like the prospect of owning a home is a pipe dream. And I guess that's kind of, you know, having an interest. I've always been quite practical and hands-on. And, you know, the idea of building your own house is something that lots of people entertain. And I guess kind of bringing those two things together, of being like, actually realizing there's a crop that I could grow that would be good for farmers and good for the environment, and, you know, good, it's a pollination crop, it's got, don't get me started on the kind of benefits of it, but that also creates really high performing healthy buildings. And you're just like, why are we not doing that?
Well, I think we will get into it, because I think it's worth talking about why the natural building, because of the, I mean, they're benefits, they're not co-benefits, they're essential to it. But in fact, we might get into it now, because like something that crops up in the conversation that we had the other day was, you'd looked at it from, you wanted to build a biogenic or an organic or more natural supply chain for building. That's a bold goal, isn't it?
Well, it started with being like, oh, I'd like to grow some hemp because I can see that it has value and it is an interesting crop and it's good for the environment. And then it was like, well, if I did grow it, what would I do with it? Obviously, you can grow it as a seed crop, and that is quite widely done across the UK. But if you're looking at the carbon capture potential of it, it's the industrial strains, which are quite different from the seed crop. And that's not actually traditionally was used for fiber, and it was grown extensively across the UK. I know you talked about this with Sam from Indonature on one of your previous episodes, but that strain of the crop isn't grown as widely. And why isn't it grown? Well, there's no processing infrastructure. And why is there no processing infrastructure? Because there's no supply chain demand. We did actually have Europe's biggest hemp processing plant was just up the road from me, and it was set up with EU funding, and it lasted for about 10 years at the turn of the millennium, and it failed in the financial crash. And there's all kinds of reasons we can get into on why that happened, but the crux is that it's a really bulky crop and it doesn't travel very well, and so you need that local infrastructure, and therefore you need localized supply chains. And I think that is the way the economy needs to move in order to push us towards decarbonization. It's decentralization and localization. And so that was kind of where this all started. I basically approached someone I knew that was involved in development and construction and said, you build stuff, if I grew hemp, would you build with it? And what I didn't realize is there's this massive missing piece in the middle. But in order to justify the investment in the plant and the infrastructure for processing it, you need products that want it. And that's how I ended up starting with growing it. And now I'm manufacturing a product that can be used at the other end of the supply chain.
So do you want to tell us about the product itself then? How hemp literally and figuratively fits into it?
Yeah, so hemp from a building performance perspective, obviously, you know, natural building materials have a whole host of benefits in terms of breathability, moisture management and air quality. But I guess the difference with the material that we've developed that is in our panels, it's called Hempsil, and it's basically the same as hemp lime from a performance perspective, but we use an alternative binder to lime. And the reason we use the hemp shiv, which is so within the industrial plant, when you process it, you get the fiber that can go off to make lovely fiber insulation bats. And then the stalk becomes a kind of wood chippy material that is commonly used in horticulture and in animal bedding, horse bedding in particular. So it's a low value, bulky product. And it's just coincidental that that has inherent pore structure properties that make it very, very good at moisture buffering. So it's very, very good at stabilizing the relative humidity in buildings. Anyone who knows about hemp lime, I don't know if you've had hemp lime people on, I'm sure you have. I haven't listened to the whole back catalog.
I'm not on the podcast yet. No, actually.
Well, there's a whole world out there. But in basic principles, that's what it does. It stabilizes the relative humidity in a building at 55%, which happens to be the sweet spot for human inhabitants. And that's just an inherent property. And I, to my knowledge, there aren't really other materials that do it, certainly not as efficiently. And so actually, when you can get that material into the internal base of buildings, then there's all kinds of benefits. And with that moisture management comes thermal performance. You start getting into relatively complicated building physics, but basically it has a thermal mass many times greater than its physical mass. So it's a lightweight material, but it performs more like a denser material.
Yeah, you do get moisture buffering benefits from some other biogenic materials too. Wood fiber, for instance, is, you know, and cellulose kind of related to that tend to have pretty good forms. And the whole kind of decrement factor issue, in terms of, you know, I guess it's, I don't want to get into it because it's kind of mind melting, you know, but this kind of thermal inertia thing is really important.
Jeff, what did you say? Deck wood factoring?
Decrement factor.
Decrement factor.
I'm not even going to attempt to explain it now. Just Google it, okay? It's to do with the non-factor. You know what? I'm not even going to bother.
I remember looking at it with a product brief recently, but
it's to do with the length of time that it takes for heat to pass through insulation. You know, so if you've got an insulant in a roof with a good decrement factor, will time lag will mean that you've got a much lower risk of overheating in the summer is how it's going to work, you know, than with a material which might have a good U value, but poor thermal, but poor decrement factor. You know, that's the thinking.
It's the caravan effect versus the church effect, right? When you walk into an old church, you feel the cooling from the density of the materials, and vice versa. With a caravan, it gets very hot very quickly because it has a very bad decrement delay factor. But I think the thing about hemp composites is that it gets more complicated because it's a byproduct of the moisture buffering that it does. So the way I describe it, I am technically a layman, I don't have a technical background, but you know, when you perspire and you sweat and that process of evaporation cools you down, well, basically in the moisture exchange within the materials, that's what it does. So it stops the material from overheating and therefore reduces heating and cooling loads, which is something we're actually doing some research with the University of Hertfordshire at the moment, trying to quantify and measure, but it is very, very hard to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, I love these kind of building physics rabbit holes. It's you know, the more we can understand this stuff, the better. You mentioned a low carbon binder. Is this some sort of secret sauce now, or is this something? Oh yeah, you can't share that.
No, so my business partner, so I founded the company originally with two architects and a developer, and then we started prototyping using hemp lime. I went on a course with the UK Hempcrete lot and learned about hemp lime as a material and was, you know, kind of fell in love with it, I suppose. And then when we set out to start thinking about how we could use that, the kind of push towards a modular solution and a panelized kind of structure came from my business partner, who has a background in construction and development. And we did do some prototyping with hemp lime, but it was heavy, it was messy, it was hard to dry. We were kind of having all the problems that people using the material have in general. And so we kind of kept getting referred to some academics, in particular the University of Bath was really well regarded, and there was a lecturer there called Dr. Mike Lawrence, who is a specialist in hemp lime and has over 100 papers co-authored on the subject. And so we went to him and said, this is what we're trying to do, these are the problems we're having. And he said, oh no, that'll never work with hemp lime. And we were like, ah, well, that's a bit tricky because we're quite invested now. Have you got any better suggestions? And it turns out he did. So it's a similar material, but it's a mineral-based binder, but it doesn't have the same challenges in terms of adding water into the process, which is one of the big drawbacks with hemp lime, is just how long it takes to kind of cure and set once you've built with it.
Okay. And tell me, I mean, looking at the photographs, I'm seeing like, you know, like an OSB board sort of structure. Well, I don't know if it's structural or if it's, or what is the structure actually of the wall system?
Yeah, so it is a structural panel system. And that was, once we'd worked out what the composites and the materials were, that was the next goal. So we actually built a big structural test rig and we spent a lot of time in the beginning building stuff and crushing it again, which wasn't as explosive or exciting as you might imagine, more just creaks and groans and little cracks. But the panels are engineered and we've iterated with different materials and different combinations. There's still already, I'd say there's about 10 different types of material within the panel, but the version we've landed on and that we're kind of pushing forward with testing is effectively a structural OSB casing. And then we use two panel vent boards, but effectively a vapor permeable kind of MDF type board. And then within the panel, you've got our layer of hemp sill at 100 mil at the front of it. And then you've got another structural latticed board in the middle, followed by a layer of fiber. And together, that means that the panels can take structural loading up to three stories with a commercial loading effectively without needing a primary structure. Although until it's certified, we would do so just with an abundance of caution for anything above a single story. But basically, yeah, they're really high capacity structural panels that can be configured in, you know, they're interoperable. So the idea is that it's like a kit of parts and you can basically make any building that you want out of the system. You can use standard, but we can also do bespoke parts. We've done some really interesting kind of roof typology, kind of building forms and things on pilots in the past.
So what sort of things have you managed to build from the system so far?
Yeah, so we started out with smaller garden studio type buildings. We've done four or five of those. And then we progressed on to slightly bigger things. So we last year did two small classroom spaces for a charity in Suffolk. And then we also did a two-story install within a construction college. That was actually our first two-story install. And we did a residential extension, so a kitchen extension, which again was just absolutely mental geometry. It was fitting. It was an infill site, a little tight infill down the side of a house. And I think really we bit off the hardest end of the market there and proved that effectively we can use the system with any architecturally led design process. And now we're looking at the year ahead. We've got some more schools, we've got some additional smaller garden studios. The goal is to be doing volume house building. That's where we want to get to, but obviously that's subject to the whole certification process, which can be quite drawn out.
Yeah, so start with Wendy houses and extensions and work your way up.
Exactly.
How big do you think you can get with this?
So it's not limited. I mean, obviously the parts themselves are limited by the size of a sheet of material, so OSB. But actually, once you introduce a primary structure, it could go, you can go as big or as, you know, as big as you can get spans. We use LVLs for the primary structure when we do introduce a primary structure. So, but in theory, you can build skyscrapers.
I mean, we shouldn't be building skyscrapers anyway, but yeah, for a bunch of reasons in sustainability terms. But yes, you're right. If we're building them, build them out of these kinds of materials, you know. Yeah.
So you mentioned that you highlighted a digital aspect to the design process as well, as if that was a significant thing. I don't mean to say that demeaningly.
No, it absolutely is. Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the challenge with natural materials, is they're kind of bookmarked with the kind of Birkenstock kind of, and I think actually trying to show that they can be brought into a very technologically driven, innovative mainstream. Obviously, there are other digitally fabricated systems out there, but basically we precision engineer the parts down to within a millimeter tolerance. So basically, when you get to site, it all just slots together. There's no waste. It's, you know, effectively an overcomplicated, oversized Lego set that you can click the panels together. We use a timber fixing approach that is thanks to the precision engineering, which means you can disassemble it relatively easy. It's like a butterfly peg that you can knock through in order to aid with ease of disassembly. But basically, the digital stuff is about automating the design process. So the way that it will work in the near future is you'll be able to, as an architect, upload your building model and then specify our system, and it will configure your building with our system, and it will tell you the bill of parts, the cost, the carbon automatically. So at the moment, we have a lovely team of junior architects who spend a lot of time manually remodeling, even just for the purposes of giving cost estimates. It's quite a drawn out process. And so basically we're using technology, and it is kind of parametric tools to completely streamline that. So there should be no limitation on the building that you can create.
Parametric tools?
Yeah, so parametric tools, it's, again, it gets quite techy and complicated, but it's kind of AI-based design tools. So it will, you can basically flex. So our parts can be flexed or changed to any geometry very easily without it kind of making lots of manual work for us.
What about things like the thicknesses? Can you vary that, or is it a standard sort of thickness?
Yeah, so the way it works is that the panels are a standard thickness. They're 175 mil, and within there you've got your 100 mil of your hemp sill and your 60 mil of the lovely Indonature fiber, which, side note, is great because they get their raw material from the same farm that we do. So we're already combining the same industrial hemp plants within our panels, and that's kind of part of the long-term vision of it. But what we then add is a variable layer of wood fiber on the outside, which is how you would achieve your different U values. And then there's a fixed grid. So the panels are always 600 mil wide, but they increase for the standard parts. They go in increments of 300 in height. And then if you want additional different funny shapes, that's getting into bespoke territory, which just has a cost implication to it, really.
And presumably the wood fiber board, the thermal bridging should be relatively low anyway, but the wood fiber board external to the structure kind of helps to kind of, you know, kill that even further, right?
Yeah, exactly. And our whole thing is thinking about disassembly at the design stage. So even, for example, with that, we have a unique bracket system that we've developed where you basically fix the wood fiber using battens to hold it on. So you don't have to use the mechanical fixings that, you know, then would be a challenge when it comes to removing or disassembling it.
That's a bit that I found really interesting. The fact that you're planning for its end of life at the beginning of its life. And that's not to suggest that it's a temporary structure. Like, you're planning, what, 50-year lifespan, 60-year lifespan? But as with any building, if you look after it, it hypothetically could last forever. Or theoretically.
Exactly. But, yeah, especially, you know, there are natural materials that have been stood for 600 years. So it's definitely something that we would like to see the panels effectively disassembled and then reused in other projects. Obviously, there's questions in terms of typical, you know, application. And for example, a reconditioned panel probably wouldn't be guaranteed structurally anymore, but would be fine for a single story infill, etc. And the process of the disassembly has led us, definitely been the hardest kind of objective to keep to. It's very easy to just throw screws in, but we've come up with, and it's actually using some fairly traditional Japanese timber techniques. You know, they used to make timber frame buildings without using a single screw, and so we've taken inspiration from some of those joints and techniques. And it means that you can basically remove a panel without disrupting the surrounding panels. So if you had localized damage, or you wanted to, you know, swap it out for whatever reason, to put a doorway in or change a window, you don't actually have to. Obviously, if you've got to break your finishes and your plasters, etc. And it's not, we've had some people kind of go too far the other way and they say, oh, well, if it's so easy to disassemble, how do you stop people stealing bits of your buildings? You're like, well, it's not that easy, but it's just thinking through the process ahead of time and trying to make it as easy as possible so that ultimately those materials don't have to end up in a skip, which is all about keeping that carbon in use for as long as possible.
I was going to mention Japan, actually, because I recall reading about these famously, these Japanese timber frame temples. There's one that's like a UN World Heritage site. It's something like 1400 years old or something crazy like that. And if I remember correctly, I don't know if it's this temple, but it gets disassembled and reconstructed every so often. So there's amazing kind of extraordinary insights that we can draw from, and you actually are, which is amazing.
For some reason, in my Instagram feed, I get quite a lot of Japanese woodwork from people just putting those funny little videos where they show you someone sawing off the corner of a piece of wood and making some other incisions and then miraculously fitting the bits together. I've never searched for any of that stuff. I don't know how it knows, but I find myself transfixed by them. Because it's
but within that, there is an incredible amount of skill required, understandably. And I think these days, the thing is, we've got the technology that exists where you can just get the computers and the machines to do all that skillful stuff for you so that the actual install process becomes really accessible and really kind of simple, effectively.
Oh, pick up. Yeah. Like my brain can't do those three-dimensional gymnastics from all those different angles. I don't suffer from that, not being able to visualize things, real things in my mind's eye. But like, I can't go that far.
Oh, it's a fascinating challenge that we have where you do an assembly drawing of a part and then you go to put it together. And we try and design things so that it's really as easy as possible. You can, you know, it's all like you can only put it together one way, but you don't realize that if you start with one piece back to front, you can build the whole thing inside out and it all fits apart from the last piece. And you're kind of left scratching your head trying to work out what's gone wrong. It's it's quite a challenging one.
And as is the circularity issue. Trying to build in a way that makes things last, in a way that you can build for perpetual use and reuse and for an end of life at the same time. Not because you've got to do the same sort of mental physics gymnastics, but like it's the same. It's when you talked about like biogenic supply chains. So a biogenic supply chain, it doesn't just go from a field to a processing plant to a manufacturing plant to a house. Like the biogenic supply chain happens after that, because where we are thinking about things like embodied carbon, we are accounting for end of life. And it's not like end of life where it's going to be recycled, because you can't strictly recycle hemp.
Well, you can't. It obviously can be decomposed, but it also can be put into energy incineration. And that is what, you know, when we've been doing LCAs and looking at our products, there is assumptions made about the ultimate end of life. There's obviously this module D stuff, which is the kind of circularity and reuse piece. But then ultimate end of life, it can go into energy recovery. But the thing is that lots of the crops and the materials we're most interested in using are typically grown for energy. So actually what we're saying is, why don't you put it in a building for 60 years and use that building as a way to store the carbon. And this is why, you know, I know we could spend days getting into the debate on a carbon negative, embodied, you know, carbon positive, climate positive, whatever stuff. But I think that when you're talking about trees, I absolutely think that you shouldn't be claiming carbon negativity, not only because that carbon will ultimately be released, but also because by cutting a tree down, you're preventing its ability to carry on sequestering carbon. When you're taking annual biomass crops, that carbon is going to be released at the end of that year. If you leave it in the field, it's going to decompose. You know, actually, if you could do that on a significant enough scale, I mean, the government is investing billions of pounds in direct air carbon capture, which is using energy to suck it out of the air and pump it under the North Sea and hope that it stays there for 100,000 years, or else it's completely pointless anyway. And they're allowed to call that carbon capture. And if they are, then I think natural building materials should be allowed to too. So that's my stance.
Well, yeah, you make a strong point. I suppose when we're talking about carbon negativity in the sense it's the standards that you have to do embodied carbon calculations to, and you would object to this and perhaps correctly would tell you that even if the material is reused at its end of life, it passes out of the boundary conditions of the life cycle assessment onto the next one as a negative into the, you know, a minus figure in the next one.
Sure.
So it's as if the sequestration doesn't exist in that regard, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that does a disservice to the fact that we have a carbon and a climate crisis in the next 10, 20 years. Like, I think the whole plus one, minus one, well, because in 60 years, it's a minus one, therefore we can't claim it as a credit now, but yet developers can pay and claim carbon credits for planting bamboo plantations on the other side of the world. Like, there's just, I think it's just a missed opportunity. And I think that I absolutely recognize they have to have rigor and structure to the way that they account for these things, but it's doing a disservice to short cycle biomass and biogenic materials in general. And actually, we could be pumping that money into building houses and storing carbon.
I think there's an argument. This moisture buffering thing that John Butler talks about is a potentially neat way of solving it, but it requires you maybe to think about setting a target for it, for instance. And I don't know, of course, the target only applies if you're actually using these kinds of materials. But in other words, the idea that you have the fear, and I would be an advocate of timber use in construction with caveats, right? The fear is you probably see it too, Chloe. There's an awful lot of people presenting a mass timber building. A mass timber, again, has its role, but like for a low-rise building, the whole principle should be use the least amount of the least polluting materials you can for the most impact, right? And sparing use of timber for maximum impact, for instance, is a really good way to kind of approach that. If you need to build at all, that is, you know.
And that's why, so we started out using birch plywood for our cassettes because, you know, we knew we wanted it to be structural, but actually as we've iterated it, we've realized, well, not only is that impossible to source and incredibly expensive these days, but actually you don't need it and you can use OSB, which is made from a lower grade of lumber, which is, you know, effectively more accessible. Yeah. And in an ideal world, you know, there are products emerging that are substituting timber with products made from short cycle biomass, even short rotation coppice timber. So things like willow and poplar, fast growing short carbon types of timber. You know, actually my ideal would be that we're not using any timber in our product at all, but obviously practicalities and needs must and all that.
I think that's something that needs to be addressed. So it's like, don't let perfect get in the way of good or something. I can't remember that.
Yeah.
Don't let the
perfection is the enemy of progress or whatever.
Yeah, or the excellent be the enemy of the very good or whatever. Yeah, they're all.
Yeah. What are they? Make up your own version. We've given you all the parts. We keep coming across solutions or responses to the myriad crises around us, which are fundamentally imperfect because you can see risks baked into them or poor practice. And it sort of comes down to, I mean, I've sort of, having been ruminating on this quite a lot, thinking about what Fionn Stevenson said the other week when we had her on, like her concern, also as an advocate for biogenic building products, she is all behind the idea that we need to insulate more, but wants us to use natural building materials as a means of minimizing the carbon burp because we may have already passed our carbon budget. But the thing is, the way the system is, it doesn't give a shit about what we would like things to be like. It just is. And its gears are going to keep grinding away. And the carbon burp that is being emitted beyond our budgetary boundaries, well, it pays them no mind, does it? And we've just got to suck up the fact that some of the things that we're going to do are a bit shitty, actually. Like, I thought Kensa's heat the streets, heat pump idea is magnificent. Like, I think it's wonderful, except baked into it is this sort of anxiety that I have about a private equity firm being able to buy that street's heating infrastructure. Like, once they're cut off from any sort of like a gas grid or whatever else, and they could find themselves beholden to a PE firm. Now, Kensa says they've answered that problem in the way that the lease or the covenants or whatever have been put together. And similarly with we're getting Octopus Energy on to talk about their zero bills homes. What a magnificent idea. But what a big carbon burp. You know, like load it up with insulation that's probably not going to be natural building materials. Stick as much solar on it as you can and use that to power the home and feed back to the grid. But I don't care how much carbon's emitted there, because if they can get that sort of work carried out at scale, they catalyze the whole industry in a way that we've been scratching around trying to work out how people, there's a skills deficit. So how do you get people to get better at building to something approaching the passive house standard? And it doesn't all have to be passive house, like just better is better. That's what we care about. And like, we have to make these sorts of compromises, don't we? Like, just let's crack on. Like, we've got a compromise. We're going to have to
be careful with the non-passive house thing, though, Dan. You know, I mean, it kind of depends on what you mean. And
there's
a question
light.
I wanted to ask you about.
There's
a question I wanted to ask you.
Carbon light, Jeff, Chloe, is fine. Well. Carbon light is fine. And we're all happy with that. And even the fucking Passive House Institute, Susanna Vinkel, she gave a presentation to the Buildings Action Coalition a few months before Christmas, like November, in which she said, not every retrofit has to be NFIT.
Like, exactly. No, I understand, but I'm just taking a little bit of care. And I wanted to ask Chloe as well where they stand on things like airtightness and on passive house, for instance, you know.
Absolutely.
Where do you see yourselves in that regard?
I guess just to kind of tie off that that previous line of thinking, I think just one thing to flag is that, you know, there is a myriad of challenges all wrapped up in buildings, both retrofit and new build. And we're very much trying to focus on new build because in some ways that's the easiest kind of end of the market. But certainly it's a complex problem. There is no one silver bullet solution. And that is a challenge we get leveled at us, is that we have developed a product that some might say is overcomplicated or, you know, over-engineered. But that's why, so the product is called ADEPT, the ADEPT system. And that's because ADEPT basically means being good at doing something that is quite difficult. And that's kind of the point. Like, we are trying to build in solutions to some of these complex challenges by front loading the complexity into the manufacturing and the design stage, so that the building and the installation process is as low skilled and easy as possible within limits. I think in terms of the whole passive house air tightness thing, absolutely buildings need to be airtight and energy efficient, very much support the passive house movement in general. But we obviously prioritize the use of natural materials. And as a result, we want to make sure that the building is able to breathe from a moisture perspective. Obviously, there's common misconceptions even amongst architects about the difference between vapor and air permeability. And we would absolutely be wanting to achieve an airtight building, but we want it to be vapor and moisture permeable. And so and I guess the underlying goals of the system is obviously it being designed for disassembly, prioritizing the use of low carbon and natural materials, but also avoiding petrochemical materials wherever possible. And so that means that we're really actually against using membranes if we can help it. Obviously, needs must. If building control say it needs a membrane, we'll put a membrane in. But our approach to air tightness is that we air tightness tape all of the joints internally before the wood wall board, and then the plaster layer would effectively go on. So we don't want to put a membrane on the warm side of the wall if we can help it. We're doing air tightness tests and things at the moment. We've got a bunch of buildings that have been monitored for a couple of years now, so we know that the in-use performance very much matches the modelled performance. But certainly we would be aiming for passive house levels of performance. We work with passive house architects on all of our junctions, and details are all kind of designed with the principles in mind, but we aren't technically likely to become a passive house accredited product.
So it would be a struggle with the kind of tech you're using. It would be a struggle to get to be able to guarantee that you can get the 0.6 air changes per hour. Is that the issue, is it?
It's not something we've been able to do yet. It's not something that we've only, as I say, done quite small buildings. And, you know, for example, doing the first residential project we've done is an extension on an older building. So it's not like we're going to get any useful data from that. So it's definitely something we'll be aiming for, but we haven't got the data to kind of see how far off we are at the moment.
Interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting kind of challenge. I think it's, as the grid decarbonizes, it's very easy and tempting for people to, in some cases, it may be justified to think about moving away from such a concern around, say, space heating usage. So if people are electrifying heat and so on, and they're getting good energy performance, and maybe as you're saying in the test projects, you're talking about you're getting good performance. But I'm nervous about trading off energy performance reductions against embodied carbon improvements. I think we have to try and find ways to do both, you know?
Yeah, no, and it's absolutely shouldn't be a trade-off. I think the thing is, there's been so much progress made on the operational efficiency side of things, and such a much more widespread understanding of the importance of it, and the grid decarbonization coming along means that even now the embodied carbon proportion of a building's carbon footprint is, I think it's 49%. It might have even tipped over. It's like the majority of a building's lifetime carbon is emitted before you've ever stepped foot through the door. So now we need to turn our attention to trying to also address that, recognizing that they're massive challenges individually, let alone in combination.
So what about MMC, modular building? What a shit show. Do you feel, I'm really curious, like it feels like
this is an MMC, Dan, you know.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. That's exactly where I'm going. Like,
are you happy with what you're being lumped with?
We are tarnished with that brush. But I think it is, you know, the criticisms leveled at that side of the industry are absolutely valid. And you just look at the corpses that are falling by the wayside on a practically weekly basis. I mean, it is a real challenge. But I think that I've been to see some of these factories, some of the ones that are no longer in existence. And it, for me, coming from outside the industry and not actually being that familiar with the practices, it was really reassuring to kind of go, well, that's definitely not what we're doing, and that I'm happy about that. You know, you're taking the same blokes, the same people, the same tools and you're putting them into a barn. It's predominantly, and when you're putting them into a big barn with massive overheads and energy bills, and you put them in this car manufactured approach where you get all these bottlenecks and it's a, you know, continuous production line. And then you try and combine that with the stop, start, boom, bust nature of the construction industry. And it's like, no wonder you've got some problems. And that's definitely something that we've been aware of, basically not going down that route. We did look and explore volumetric right back in the beginning, and very quickly, because we knew we wanted it to be panelized, we tried doing like pre-assembling the panels into bigger units. But we realized that because each one can be manually handled anyway, by the time you've got specialist lifting equipment and cranes and access and all that involved, you might as well just send it as a kit flat pack and do it on site. And so that's the angle that we are leaning in. And definitely, I think the kit of parts approach is where the future is. The kind of 2D category 2, 2D structural approach, I think, is where the industry is recognizing it's heading. Because the conventional, you know, volumetric Cat 1 type of stuff, as all of the public inquiries evidence was being presented recently, they were basically saying it's more expensive. And I feel like if you can't benefit from the efficiencies and the cost savings of that manufacturing-led approach, then what's the point?
Well, yeah. So you say flat pack, like, and 2D. So how flat are you talking about? You're talking about for even the OSB, for instance, coming in just in OSB sheets.
So the cassettes are basically pre-assembled. So you've got these 600 by 175 by, you know, 2.4 is the standard size. They weigh just under 60 kilograms. So technically two people can lift them. We've done an installation where we did some internal partitions in a retrofit project where they had to get carried up two flights of stairs in a central London building. So the idea is that the panels are as adaptable and kind of flexible from a install, but also a handling perspective. Some of the other panelized systems that technically are still 2D, you know, they still require craneage and lifting equipment. So we're trying to find that sweet spot. Basically, the goal is to develop a system that conventional laborers, carpenters, site chippies can use without them having to reskill or bring in specialist equipment or any of that.
So you can use the digital design process to design for tricky access to a site. Like if you had to pass a panel through the eye of the needle,
a door frame, you can get them all through a doorway,
right? Because that's really interesting as well. Like not just with relation to building things like garden sheds, but thinking about, so like my missus and I, we did manage to buy a house. I say buy a house. We bought a massive debt, but while we were looking around where we live, there's quite a lot of bungalows where we live now. Just because of the way things were developed way back then. And they've all got big gardens, or nearly all of them have big gardens. And so you can see all this space like that's underutilized. But having done like landscape gardening and bits of demolition, I could see all the arsehole of trying to do anything with that space because, you know, it's like funny steps, a really narrow passage, a long winding path to the site, which you can conceivably use because it's, oh man, a really good space. So your system can accommodate that sort of arsehole if you can get through a doorway.
Yeah, so we did one project at the University of Suffolk site over in Ipswich at the BT Martlesham site where we delivered it all in box vans and basically transferred the panels onto pneumatic trolleys, basically glorified wheelbarrows, and carried, you know, effectively moved them over a large grassy area without doing any damage, without needing massive lifting equipment. So yeah, that's kind of part of how we tried to design it so that it's super flexible.
Wow. And how fast can stuff be built? I'm just thinking like emergency response stuff. Jeff and I were speaking with a volumetric builder.
Yeah, volumetric modular.
Volumetric modular, cool. Because there is a nuance of people don't like getting lumped in with everyone else. As I understand it, I'm still relatively new to this. And they were describing temporary structures being created for Ukrainian refugees in areas of Ireland, which took as long as it would have for them to build permanent structures and have cost as much as it would for them to have created permanent structures that could be put into a site and like, oh man. But yeah, like, so what about you guys? Like, how quick is it to turn something around?
It's super quick to install the panels. So, I mean, we've done like a 300, anyone who went to UK Construction Week last October, we did a 300 square meter install there for an industry group called Zero Construct. And that was up in a day. So none of the projects we've done where it's the panels has taken more than, I'd say, three to four days. But the thing about our system, and in the beginning, we perhaps oversold on some of our early projects because we knew from doing prototyping and testing that the panels, you literally just lift them in, you knock the pegs in, it takes minutes. But then you have the layer of wood fiber externally and the wood wallboard internally and then plasterboard. And that's the bit where, you know, it takes as long as it takes to do those processes. So I would say that the panel installation is, you know, probably 20% of the build time. And that takes, you know, a matter of days, depending on the size of the building. But we've done a full garden studio installed and plastered and finished within a week. Plastered, not plaster, but same.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that'll do. Yeah. they can wallpaper it at that point, can't they?
Yeah.
So how secure do you feel in this febrile market for MMC? Because there's no good reason for a lot of these businesses to have failed, apart from either mismanagement of business or the process, like decisions being made at a level that you don't get to see, really. Like, it's absurd that so many businesses have gone bust. Like, the Ilka went under last year, made no sense. Like, seeing BT Passive go under. Well, I mean, that might make a bit more sense. The purist approach has its limitations. It's great for brand credibility, but we don't need to get into that. But yeah, how secure do you feel in a market like that? What's your read on the market, rather?
I think from our perspective, it is incredibly challenging because there is such a nuance. You know, people hear MMC, like investors often, they have a blanket, we don't invest in MMC policy. And that makes it, you know, you're trying to, it's a hard sell because you're like, well, that's not exactly what, you know, we are MMC, but we're not because we're doing it differently. And I think there is a reputational risk of being associated. You know, there are some real horror stories, the Caledonian modular schools, and, you know, where the quality of modular construction has really not been up to scratch. And rightly, that should be challenged and picked apart. But I think that, yeah, for us being very much focused on not just the natural materials and the environmental aspect, but also the quality and the health of the buildings and the occupants, our goal is to show that you can achieve that and do it in a cost efficient way. But it's so often leveled at us that if those big boys and players in the, you know, in that end of the industry can't make this work, then how are you, scrappy little startup, gonna do it? And it's an ongoing challenge. We're still kind of trying to raise investment and build the case for effectively what we want to achieve is a place where we collaborate with some of those people and we actually get them manufacturing our panels, because we're not tied. I want to see this. The point of this is to scale it up and to increase, you know, one little factory in the east of England isn't going to create enough demand to stimulate the whole hemp industry across the UK. And the whole point of the panels being super flexible is that people could integrate them into their existing product ranges. Or, you know, we ideally don't want to be a customer facing organization. We want to be a B2B organization, working with those customer facing contractors and organizations that basically would do the manufacturing and the installation. And we have a lot of interest internationally from other people that are doing, you know, particularly in Europe, where they're already quite familiar with timber structural systems, who are saying, oh, you know, what you're doing is a nice value add, or an, you know, another string to our bow. But to be honest, it's all, you know, chicken and egg stuff with scaling and getting investment and having certification and market penetration and all of those things. And, you know, obviously at the end of the day with a startup, it comes down to the credibility of the founding team. And I think being at the helm as a non-technical, non-construction person who didn't even go to university, trying to convince big developer investors to give me millions of pounds to build a factory, you know, it is a hard sell. And so that's something we're still grappling with. But I was quite vindicated, or reassured, I guess, as much as this is a terrible fact to have, that last year more companies with a managing director called David got investment than companies with a female managing director. And, you know, I was like, well, maybe it's not just me.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Especially in our industry, You know, it doesn't cover itself in glory.
But there are some really interesting ecosystems out there. And obviously there are a lot of these accelerator programs and things that are very specifically looking at the built environment, as they should. I've found those networks and groups to be very supportive. And to be honest, you know, we've been quite scrappy from the beginning and, you know, doing it ourselves. Like, I loved doing the early research work and being able to go on the courses and do the physical side of it. And so really, we're just focused on kind of building the business case from the bottom up and proving the viability of it. And until we've got one factory that is kind of viable and up and running, I think trying to achieve that networked approach and scaling it up beyond that is obviously a challenge.
There's a really strong and easy to tell story in terms of, it's almost like a franchise proposition as much as anything else, because if you can demonstrate a factory of a certain size can work in an area with a particular environment, and I mean that in the agricultural terms, because like we had this conversation with Sam Bamber from Indie Nature, where I am right now in the Northwest in Lancashire, like there's no industry left here. There's nothing. I mean, they don't even have call center jobs. The town I'm from, Chorley, it's a commuter town now. There's nothing much left in it. There's one factory. That's about it. And the idea that you could breathe some actual tangible life back into the agricultural economy, and you could tie that to a manufacturing and processing infrastructure supply chain that could then be turned into an actual product that wasn't deleterious in all sorts of regards, that was contributing to the economy. We're just down the road from Preston. You know, it's very close. And so that sort of community wealth building aspect, I mean, the prospect of it is really tantalizing. Like, it's,
I mean, that's my background, right? I worked in the youth and charity sector for 10 years and at a national level working for national charities. And that's really where I got my experience in running businesses, was from being a trustee and seeing kind of that side of it. But growing up in this rural community, I lived in London for 10 years. And when I stepped back from that and actually said, like, what can I give back and what's like unique to where I grew up? What are the challenges here and how can I help with that? And that's kind of where this came from. And there are certainly other businesses like ours that are doing a similar thing, but they're leaning, I would say, too much into the automation and technology. They're like, we're just going to have big robot arms everywhere and they're going to do everything. When actually, if you find a middle ground, then you can do job creation and you can do employment opportunities and upskilling in an environment that isn't, you know, traipsing around muddy building sites in the winter, but, you know, trying to find that sweet spot.
Well, this whole idea about shifting away from oil age architecture, can't remember if we discussed
which is an
this.
Amazing, which is, I've heard you use the phrase on the podcast, and I think it's so hard to articulate, like, the transition that's needed, and I think that sums it up in very few words.
Lovely, isn't it? You know, props to Jeff, like, presuming he is the one who came up with it, but we've not found it anywhere else yet. If anyone who's listening has heard anyone use it elsewhere.
I do have a tendency to think I've created things, that I've actually robbed from somebody else, you know.
And we would love to be able to offer attribution if someone knows who the actual author of that is, because it alludes specifically, indirectly, to the fact that oil age architecture encapsulates what amounts to an exploitation economy, like global, imperial.
Absolutely.
Where this shift is to something quite different. So like you referred to your competitors employing robots, like that's a really fragile ecosystem that costs an awful lot of money and requires an awful lot of investment, which means a few people make an awful lot of money. But if you're bootstrapping to a point and keeping the infrastructure, creating your own value chain, which is of an appropriate size that uses people to a certain degree of skilled labor, you get people buying into the system, you get people getting employed at a fair rate so they can buy into the system further, you get money being spent in a local economy, and you build a fundamental resilience into what you are creating rather than a high-level economic opportunity that will sit on someone's portfolio's balance sheet. And there is something that, this is why, having met you and the guys at Future Build, having spoken to them, and again, why we were quite enthused by what Indie Nature are doing, it's that you're investing in stuff, like actual stuff that you can touch and feel. It's not investing in a percentage return opportunity that exists in the ether that could just evaporate.
I think you summed you've summed that up really well. And I guess in some ways that maybe articulates why it is hard for me to sell it to venture capitalists and equity investors and people like that. And I think, you know, there's all myriad of challenges in there, but it,
just mention
it does
blockchain
remind me
too, Chloe. Yeah,
exactly. Throw that one in. It does remind me of a conversation. I was at a roundtable event with a government advisor not that long ago, and there was this debate about how the UK is really good at investing in research, but it's not very good at supporting scale up, and that often companies get poached by international investors and taken abroad in order to do that scale up piece. And the government advisor turned around and said, well, it's not the government's job to subsidize commercial activities and exploitation. And I guess on the face of it, like, that seems like, yeah, that's fair enough. But actually, as I kind of was thinking after that, it's, you know, businesses like ours are effectively trying to internalize the environmental consequence of our products. Like, we're intentionally trying to create something that is better for the environment. And we're up against all of these massive conglomerates and corporations that have effectively been subsidized by oil age architecture and by the petrochemical industry. That is what means that those materials are so prevalent and so cheap. And so actually, really, the government should be stepping in to support businesses that are trying to do differently and do it better. But, you know, again, complexity, and that's a hard sell.
Well, I think this is why an organization like yours potentially has a greater resilience than someone like Ilka did, because for all the, like, the grand plans, the sequential growth out of, what was it, Keepmoat first, like, it grew into another entity. It seemed really robust. They had great ideas. They had so much opportunity in where they'd situated the site, like the market demand, but there was a break there somewhere. And from what I understand, someone made a decision, and we can probably presume money had to do with that decision. Either they were going to make money, or someone else was going to make money, or there was the potential to lose money. Like, risk is involved in a different way. And then it just becomes a balance sheet decision. Well, we can do without that, can't we? Thank you. Bye. Thousands of potential jobs, or 1,000 actual jobs. And then if you're building at this scale with this sort of infrastructure, you sort of mitigate those concerns because people are locked into what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, we're trying to build it in at every level of the organization, but you also see it in the product. So the point of the panels is that the standard panels can go into any building. So you don't need, we don't need to wait for an order to be manufacturing. And the goal there is to even out the peaks and troughs of the demand cycle that you get in construction. You know, things will inherently get delayed. There's really nothing you can do about that. And so trying to build the resilience into the way the product is designed, as well as into the way the business operates, the goal is to keep the business as lean as possible. So to work with, you know, we want to, all of our projects, we signpost to external architects. So we work with architects. And then when it comes to the installation, we partner with a contractor, which, you know, on the one hand is introducing complexity, but actually in the long run, I think that makes it a more resilient business. But does, when you then get into the silver bullet soundbite elevator pitch world, you know, even just the question of who is your customer is something we grapple with a lot, because, you know, the customer is the one that's paying for it, but that's not the person that we're selling to. And it's not the person that's doing the installation. And, you know, it very quickly becomes, again, very complicated.
Well, this is a perennial problem within the built environment, or people who make stuff to be used within the built environment. Like, it's one that we come up against time and time again, because it is hard to think beyond the things you want to say and put yourself in the shoes of the third party or fourth party consumer who isn't even thinking like a consumer necessarily, because you're talking about buildings and it's not, there's not a lot of choice.
And we say, okay, our target customer is large developers. We want to go for large scale development because that's where the carbon capture and biogenic storage potential is. And then you talk about all of the lovely features of our product and the fact that it's designed for disassembly. And then people say, oh, well, if I'm a developer, I don't care if it's designed for disassembly. So you're making me pay for a feature that doesn't have a financial benefit for me. And you're kind of saying, well, yeah, you know, we've had that. People are like, well, you know, cut the disassembly piece out of it. And you're like, oh, you're missing the point.
I think that will start to change because of the pressure that the bigger developers are already under in terms of the non-financial disclosure, sustainability reporting and stuff, you know. And that is, it's a surprise to all of us, but it's, you know, I have been stunned in a couple of cases with some very big developers at how receptive they are to things that I would be almost scared to mention to them for fear that they'd think I was a lunatic.
Yeah.
And that I never saw coming. So I think, you know, Let's just see.
I think you guys touched on it already, but the fascinating thing is that definitely we are seeing a big push coming from the finance houses and the big corporate finance institutions are pushing this. And actually we get very, even when we were like concept stage, we were getting interest from some of these massive developers who are desperately looking for solutions to these problems. But the problem is the solutions are more sustainable low carbon materials that are not currently capable of meeting the scale of demand. You know, then you get into the whole supply chain volatility, limited supply kind of debates. And, you know, you've got people, they want to build thousands of homes. And so that's definitely like, that's where we're setting our sights. But how you get there is kind of, it's not a clear trajectory either.
No.
Have you done embodied carbon calcs yet?
Yeah. So we've got our EPD draft at the moment. It hasn't been verified because we need a full year of production data to be able to actually get it accredited. But effectively, it's showing that when you scale it up to a whole, say a standard three-bed house, where your typical embodied carbon would be, say, 50 tons in the above-ground materials, ours is effectively negative, if you will tolerate me using that word, 20 tons.
Sorry, so how many
negative
tons?
Negative 20 tons. So it's storing more carbon than it takes to create it within the fabric of the building.
But we will permit that on this occasion.
Yeah, absolutely. Whether your EPD allows you to say that is another matter, right? I'm presuming that's counting like Module D, the grave robbing stage, as I call it.
Yeah, I mean, the way that we represent it is, with the obviously the biogenic aspect separated out. But yeah, if you're looking at it as a combined factor, I think it's negative 50 kilograms of CO2 per internal meter squared. So,
right. I mean, we should probably think about wrapping up, Jeff.
Yeah.
Jeff's mad busy at the moment. He's still wrestling the magazine out. Chloe, is there anything that we haven't got to talk about that you really wanted to touch on today?
No, I mean, there's obviously a million rabbit holes in relation to this subject that we could get into. I think I guess the comment you made about blockchain is quite funny because it is something that in the beginning we had some aspirations around. And I guess that's a conversation for another day. But the way that we've kind of where we've landed on that side of things and something that we are doing that I think is very much setting pace for others. And I don't know of other people. I would love to connect with people that are grappling with the same challenges. But the question of material passports and component tracking. So our goal is that every component has a unique ID and that you can therefore trace which production partner, which manufacturer, and where the hemp came from, and like maximum traceability and transparency, which is going to be important at that reuse stage to be able to trace back where did this part come from. And also, if you're looking at managing these components as kind of assets over a network, knowing when parts are coming up for reuse, etc., like it needs quite a complex asset management system effectively in place. And so we're working with industry standards. So we're working with like GS1, which is a manufacturing barcode kind of standard, and doing RFID tags. And we've been testing, you know, various different solutions. But I think that people doing digital product passports at a component level, instead of the challenges, all the conversations on material passports are about the individual materials and not about that next level up, which is what we're trying to do. So if there's anyone out there who's working in that space or has experience they can share, I'd love to connect with them. But other than that, I think we've covered off the kind of core innovations and areas that we're really interested in. And I just say I've absolutely loved, obviously Dan met you like a month ago, and so I've enjoyed listening to some of the back catalogue, because I guess I feel sometimes like I've got some very obscure interests, and actually there is a whole industry out there of people like you guys who also are interested in the same
weird and
wonderful topics
there.
And in that vein, I think we spoke about yesterday doing an episode about the history of hemp, where Chloe's an expert, Jeff, so she will deliver a curious lecture to us or something. I don't know quite how we might do it. We might do it as a bonus episode or something. It sounds interesting. And I think there's an awful lot of story in hemp that we've alluded to at various points, but we haven't really dug into as fully as we might.
Well, there's one final, just to ruin that a little bit. One question I have for Chloe: isn't it true that you can grow hemp on set aside land?
Yes. So hemp grows, it is a weed. It grows pretty much anywhere. It doesn't need fertilizers. It doesn't need irrigation. Like, that's why it environmentally has so many benefits. It's been shown to increase yields of follow-on crops when you use it as a break crop. Obviously, the set aside land piece is critical. I guess it depends where that set aside land is and kind of what the context is on it. But it's called a phytoremediator, which means it extracts heavy metals from the soil. And so they use it to decontaminate nuclear wastelands, basically. It captures the nuclear waste and you can then take it and incinerate it. So it gets rid of forever chemicals.
You could build a nuclear house for people, yeah?
Well, I wouldn't recommend that, but what they've actually shown is that it's the leaves and the flowers is where the contaminated material basically ends up. So if you were to process it for building materials, the stalk, in theory, you would actually be able to use for building without nuclearizing yourself. But I'm not sure I'd strictly recommend that. But I mean, it has a myriad of benefits. Not only is it a pollination crop, it's actually 5 times more efficient than trees at sequestering carbon. And that's another debate we won't get into today, but it's annually, it's equivalent to forestry, but its growing cycle is within 3 months. So, you know, in the terms of per acre per month, it's 5 times more efficient than timber.
Like, there is this argument, I won't go into it now, but with sequestration, to move towards dynamic sequestration. So considering how long it takes, basically, you know, and you, it, that would very much play into the hands of crops like this, you know. So
I would say it isn't just hemp that we're interested in. We're part of a project that's called the Center for High Carbon Capture Cropping. That's a big farming DEFRA funded project that's looking at not just hemp, but crops like miscanthus, which is another biomass crop that's being grown a lot. And then obviously these kind of short rotation coppices, as well as all of the underpinning systems. And the goal of that is to enable UK farmers to access carbon credits, because at the moment, as a farmer in the UK, it's near impossible to access carbon credits. As a developer, you can, you know, buy credits in a bamboo plantation on the other side of the world, but you can't invest in local carbon reduction and mitigation efforts. So we're very excited to be a part of kind of trying to broaden the scope of that. And it's the first project I know of that at such a scale that is linking construction and agriculture. So I'm really excited about it's a 4-year project, but if people are interested in this space, then there's a bunch of 20 partners working on a whole bunch of really interested stuff around that.
All right, then. Well, in that case, on that note, we will wrap up. So, yeah, that's been really interesting. Thank you very much for joining us today, Chloe.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
Thank you, everyone at home, for joining us today. All the usual things at the end. Join ACAN, join the AECB, join the IGBC. Ladies, check her own space. All of these are in the show notes. Subscribe to Passive House Plus. Advertise, if you can. This may be a vehicle for you at some point in the future, Chloe. What else, Jeff? Oh, subscribe. No, you're probably already subscribed to the podcast feed. If you aren't, please do subscribe. Please review. 5 stars, nothing else will do, because the algorithm is demanding. Oh, share it. If you get something out of this, you probably know someone else who will as well.
And talk to us about the consultancy work as well.
Yeah.
And if you can imagine the fresh horror, if the abomination of listening to us isn't enough, you could actually have a live version of that. And yeah.
All right, well, cheers. Thank you for joining us. Well, you'll hear us again, presumably, or not. I mean, fine, yeah.
Got it, yeah.
Thanks, guys. It's been great. Bye.
Excellent.
That was a good one. That was real slick down, yeah.